Chapter 5. After packing all the required gear aboard our dropships, we launched. When I say we, I am including myself. I was flying one of the Panthers, with Chen and Ray flying the others. They both had co-pilots from the commando team who were not fully qualified on the Panther, but we didn't have enough pilots aboard. As I would be remaining outside the engagement zone, I was flying alone. Reed would be flying Valkyrie, an assignment she grumbled about and gave me dirty looks, and I had every confidence she would perform with distinction. Besides, I assured her that she might have the most fun role if we got into trouble. She perked up when I said that. We both knew the merry band of pirates always find trouble everywhere we go. One major benefit of revealing our existence to the galaxy was not needing to sneak around. I mean, in this case, we were sneaking around, but that was so the Kristang did not kill their prisoners before we could secure them. We cared that the lizards did not know we were coming until it was too late, but once Smythe's team commenced blowing things up, we did not care if the lizards knew they were being attacked by humans. That new and refreshing lack of a need for a cover story is why the ground team were flying in the Maxulk's dropships we called Panthers. They were our most capable aerospace craft. But in the past, we could rarely risk using them in case our presence was discovered. That is why I had been flying a Kristang Dragon at Riker's, and it is a damn good thing. Finding me inside a Kristang dropship matched the cover story of the raid being an alien Legion operation. If I had been caught in a Thoranan Falcon or a Maxulk's Panther, it would have been an absolute disaster. The Thoranan who captured me had only been interested in verifying the bullshit cover story they downloaded from the Dragon's flight computer. Our raid annoyed, pissed off, and inconvenienced the Thoranan, but we did not scare them. That is why their ship remained in orbit after I was taken aboard. If they had found me in one of their own advanced dropships or in a Maxulk's craft, the shit would have hit the fan. Their ship would have jumped away before Skippy could return and hack into it. My skull would eventually have been cracked open, maybe after the Thoranan delivered me to their patrons. The result would have been death for me, and very possibly enslavement and extinction for humanity. Okay, sure, Friedlander still would have seen the message from Nagatha and saved the Flying Dutchman. Chang would have jumped in to retrieve Skippy. But what then? Often I rightfully accuse Skippy of being an arrogant asshole. Sometimes I am too much the opposite, not taking credit for my own accomplishments. The truth is, I don't often boast about things I have done because deep down I am terrified that everything I've done is a fluke. That I have just been lucky, and that my luck has run out. Still, it scared the shit out of me to think what could have happened if the Thoranan had a reason not to buy our cover story at Riker's. Without me aboard, Valkyrie could not have jumped away before the Thoranan recon frigate brought an entire battle group in to destroy our ghost ship. Without me and the Valkyrie, I very much doubted that Chang would have brought the Dutchman to the Beta site and investigated the hidden planet Maris. Without that, Earth would have been ground into dust by the Maxulks, and we would not have the opportunity to get t-shirts for our kick-ass tour. All those thoughts went through my mind as I warmed up my Panther for launch. We had come so close to disaster, it reminded me that little things could be the difference not only between life and death, but between mission success and failure. We launched and flew our three-ship formation of Panthers toward the planet, leaving Valkyrie behind. In the co-pilot seat beside me, Skippy was in his padded cradle, strapped tightly into the seat. Every time I looked over at him, I had a flashback to his betrayal. Skippy said that with the quantum machines in my head burned out or disabled, he could not read my thoughts. But if that was true, he had become very good at reading my body language. "Joe," he said quietly, after I cut the engines for the long coast toward the planet. "We have not flown together, just you and me, since... you know." "Yeah." I didn't look at him, keeping my concentration on the instruments, though I had absolutely nothing to do until we swung into orbit. "It makes me feel like shit to think that you are worried I will bail on you again. Please be assured that will never happen again." "Skippy," I sighed. "It's nice hearing you say that. Words are cheap. I will only know you haven't bailed when it doesn't happen." "Okay, I deserve that. I'm just saying, we have been through a whole lot of crazy shit together. You went through an unimaginable amount of shit before we met. All I know is you never know what will happen out here. The unexpected will happen." "True that," he agreed. "Remember how I declared I was right? that I have a responsibility to the galaxy overall and not just to one planet infested with filthy monkeys? If this is you trying to give me confidence you won't go running off again, you really... I am still convinced I was right about that. However, recent events have convinced me that, as unimportant as I am to the survival of all life in the galaxy, you are just as important. Damn. How do you respond when someone says you are responsible for the fate of the freaking galaxy? I am serious, Joe. I can't do this alone. What brought you to this shocking realization? When we went to Maris at the beta site. Jeez, all I wanted to do was satisfy an idle curiosity about a missing planet. When I suckered you into actually going there, I was when you... what? Maybe I misspoke. You think? Let me try that again. Let's not dwell on the past, okay? Like I said, for me, it was curiosity because I was bored. But you? You thought, there might be elder weapons hidden in there. Joe, it amazes me how your tiny monkey brain works. Then you realized we needed to plant those weapons on timers in enemy star systems. That is something I never would have thought of. If, or when, the other elder AIs begin to wake up, I can't fight them by myself. I need something the other AIs don't have. A secret weapon. A filthy, ignorant monkey with a brain the size of a raisin. Gosh, Skippy, I am blushing from your praise. You know what I mean. I am your secret weapon, huh? Well, all of the merry band of pirates are my secret weapon, but especially you. I'm a secret agent, huh? Then I should have a cool code name. He made a gagging sound and laughed. How about we use Knucklehead as your code name? No. Numbskull? Also no. Okay, then Agent Barney it is. Just call me Joe, please. I gave up. You got it. Hey, Joe. You know that I do not believe in coincidences. Yes. Hearing that set my spidey senses to tingling. A glance at the sensors did not show any threats. Why? Because we have 3 hours and 34 minutes until you need to make a course correction. Yeah, so? It just so happens that my latest operatic masterpiece is 3 hours and 24 minutes, giving you plenty of time for a potty break. In my humble opinion, this is the greatest thing I have ever written. He was wrong. My father and I used to go backpacking. One summer we took a trip to the White Mountains in New Hampshire and walked the Presidential Range. On top of Mount Washington, which was rarely and blessedly clear that day, my father told me the Appalachian Mountains used to be taller than the Himalayas, but billions of years of erosion had worn them down. Skippy was not wrong that the opera was the best thing he has ever written. It was awful. Just not as bad as anything else that came out of his musically challenged brain. He was wrong about the length. It was not around 3.5 hours. During the time I suffered through listening to his opera, the Appalachians could have risen from the sea and eroded away to their current lumpy shapes. You think I'm exaggerating? Fine. You listen to it. My Panther flew ahead of the two ships carrying the Spec Ops teams, so Skippy could gather more detailed real-time intel and hack into the planetary defense network. The Death Stalker clan had installed an extensive sensor suite on and around the planet, plus a multi-layer strategic defense satellite network. The SD network included components purchased at great expense from the Bosphorok, giving that planet a defensive edge over most Kristang worlds. We were counting on Skippy to take control of the planetary defense network, so the lizards down there would not see Smythe's team coming, and not be able to use their strategic defense weapons against the ground team, our dropships, or Valkyrie. Originally, I wanted Skippy to do even more, like basically take care of the problem for us. I asked him to hack into the maintenance robots of the compound where the keepers were being held, have the little bots scurry around and disconnect the manual detonators from the explosives. That was a good idea, he agreed. Unfortunately, it wasn't going to work. Why? Because of the Theranin. The Kristang were wary of being hacked by their patrons. And since the little green cyborgs had stated they wanted to take possession of the keepers, the lizards had increased security around the compound. That meant all maintenance bots were locked in a storage room opposite the duty guard's workstation. There was no way for bots to sneak out without being seen. I suggested that Skippy cause a real or imaginary fault with some system that would require a bot to fix it. That was also a no-go. The enhanced security procedures required a guard to watch every bot while it responded to a repair call, and it would look highly suspicious if a bot diverted to disable detonators. Plus, we couldn't fake repair orders in every building without the lizards getting suspicious. So, Smythe and his adrenaline junkies would need to disable the detonators the hard way.
Joe, Skippy groaned. This is such a pain in the ass. The lizards down there patched this network together with no thought of how difficult it would be for me to hack into it. They threw a hodgepodge of completely incompatible gear into the network and somehow expect it to work. This thing is a piece of shit. Bunch of jerks.
I'm sure they will apologize if you explain the situation.
Ha! Like that's ever going to happen. No, I will settle for crashing the computer that controls the capital city's municipal sewage system and make it flow backwards. Hee-hee!
Okay, but let that take effect after we pull the keepers off the surface.
Sure thing, Joe. Also, because I am seriously annoyed at how long it is taking me to hack into the network, I am leaving behind viruses and worms that will crash every system on this planet for months. Hey, the lizards should thank me for pointing out the huge holes in their cybersecurity.
It's the least they could do, I agreed. Privately, I was concerned. After he returned from his unscheduled vacation at Rikers, he told me he was experiencing a temporary awesomeness deficit. Then he injured himself while jumping Valkyrie through a micro wormhole. He was injured again during the encounter with the Sentinel at Waterloo, and from feedback when the relay station self-destructed with Bite Me Elmo aboard. The worst injury happened when he gave a beatdown to the entity controlling Maris. That fight really took a lot out of Skippy. While he assured me that all he needed was time to recover, he was taking longer to do relatively simple tasks, like hacking into a primitive Kristang computer system. When I asked Bilby what was going on with Skippy, our ship's slacker AI told me that he thought Skippy was distracted by using a large portion of his resources to heal the injuries. Bilby then said something that had me greatly worried. He suspected that Skippy's efforts might be directed only at containing the damage so it didn't get worse. If that were true, and hostile AIs began to wake up, we could be going into a fight without Skippy's full level of awesomeness. Crap. We had enough to worry about. How much longer? I asked, with one eye on the flight paths of the two Panthers behind us. The timing was tricky. My Panther was swinging very low around the backside of the planet, so our orbit would carry us high above the target zone and extend the time we would be overhead. If Skippy took too long to establish control over the local SD network, the dropships behind us would need to alter course to fly around the planet before they could drop the paratroops. That would force me to alter my own orbit to match, and it would become a cascade of changes we could not afford at such a late stage. I don't want to rush you, genius. Just need to give an update to Smythe.
Ah, I'm in, he sighed with disgust. We're good.
You sure?
I said I'm in, didn't I?
Well, sorry, Your Magnificence, I said to boost his obviously wounded ego. It still amazes me how fast you do stuff like that.
Toggling the transmit button, I contacted Smythe. Eagle, you are cleared for insertion. Best of luck.
Jeremy Smythe noted with no small measure of pride that his heart rate was slow and steady. Breathing deep and evenly through his nose, he watched the view below him, a sight that would terrify most people. Instead of being frightened, he was calm. Not forcing himself to be calm, he was actually enjoying the experience. Letting his arms hang loosely by his side, his legs were bent in an easy, relaxed position. Turning his head left to right, he took in a view that encompassed a vast swath of the planet from horizon to horizon. The view in his visor was entirely synthetic, as he was seeing lakes, rivers, roads, far fields, trees, and clusters of villages here and there, though it was night on that side of the world, and thick cloud cover obscured the ground. Clouds and lack of sunlight made no difference to his superb set of powered armor, a suit that was his, fitted for him, with software adjusted to his preferences, and recently modified again with Maxalt's enhancements to the basic Kristang design. The mech suit was a dream weapon, almost everything he could ask for. Almost. What he wanted was a set of infantry armor used by the Maxalt's, something he had only seen designs for. Valkyrie was a battlecruiser and had no provision for carrying infantry troops, so there had been no armor suits aboard when the ship was captured. Despite the ship's sophisticated fabricator machines, Skippy had explained, sadly, that he could not simply crank out suits of senior species combat armor. Smythe would have to be content with his current toy until the pirates could raid a Maxalk's troop ship, if that were ever to happen. One of the reasons he was so calm, as he fell out of orbit toward the planet's surface, was that he was determined to enjoy the moment, to savor the experience that might not be repeated. Bishop worried that government leaders on Earth, weary of having extinction hanging over their heads and happy to have weapons capable of devastating the galaxy, would pull back from engaging with aliens at all. UNEF leadership would retreat to Fortress Earth and let the war burn across the galaxy as it had done for countless generations. Let the aliens kill each other. It was of no concern to humanity. Jeremy feared the Special Tactics Assault Regiment would be allowed to wither on the vine, reduced to training on Earth, and slowly losing their skills, their finely honed edge. When Earth needed special operations troops again, and he was certain they would be needed, raw, untested soldiers would be thrown into a fight they weren't ready for. That was the future. This was now. According to his visor, he was falling through the upper atmosphere, the air so thin he could not hear it shrieking past his helmet, nor feel its resistance. Checking on the people in his stick, the old paratrooper formation term, he saw Gunnery Sergeant Green, who carried the portable stealth field generator strapped to his back. Green was positioned 10 meters to the left of Smythe, with three other commandos plus Gunnery Sergeant Adams in a box formation. All four corners of the box were well within the spherical stealth field, their suit computers linked and matching the movements of Green. To Smythe's left, and slightly above, was Captain Frey, with a four-member star team and their own stealth field generator. Smythe had opted to drop with the commandos so he could keep a close eye on the four people he did not know all that well. Not well enough. He trusted their bravery, their discipline, their commitment to duty. He did not trust that their limited training had given them sufficient experience in the equipment and tactics employed by a star team. The lack of experience was not the fault of the commandos, and they had performed superbly during the rescue operation on Rikers. If anyone could be blamed for the current situation, it was Bishop. The commander of the Merry Band of Pirates had not intended to bring any special operations troops with Valkyrie on the kick-ass tour of the galaxy. Smythe had to ask Chang and Sims to persuade Bishop to change his mind. He knew the reason for Bishop's reluctance to include a spec ops in the crew. Having such a capability might tempt the pirates into ill-advised adventures, like their current adventure. Smythe noted he was falling through 80 kilometers into the planet's mesosphere and past the Karman line, where aerodynamic forces began to take effect. He could feel a gentle pressure on his arms and legs, and the suit's nanomotors automatically tugged him into the proper position for a controlled glide. A hard cover had slid down over his faceplate to protect it. Everything he saw in the visor was a synthetic composite of sensor images. With his stick wrapped in a stealth field, their only knowledge of the world outside came from a tiny probe that extended beyond the field in front of Green on an ultra-thin wire and other wires that trailed behind each diver. The sensor data was enough to see that they were beginning to leave a plasma trail behind them on a long tail like a comet. Those streaks of superheated air could certainly be detected by even crewed equipment on the ground or by satellites above. As a countermeasure, the dropships had launched a rain of composite junk to fall with the paratroopers. The chemical composition of the junk matched that of the debris cloud that surrounded most inhabited worlds, orbital scrap left from space battles that constantly rained down without anyone paying much attention. Each paratrooper also had a bag of junk attached to their suits. The bags would randomly release composite pieces to burn up behind them and obscure the plasma trail of each person's fall through the atmosphere. The space junk was a backup precaution that should not be needed. Skippy's control over the planetary defense network was supposed to ensure that while sensors might detect the intruders, the sensor systems would never transmit a message about it. If a message did somehow get through via a back channel, the main defense network AI would ignore the information. The only remaining wild cards were an independent system on the ground or a ship jumping into orbit. Both risks were considered low and manageable, even by the people who would be putting their boots on the ground. In this operation, Smythe was comforted that if they got into serious trouble, Bishop would use the micro-wormhole to call in the big guns of Valkyrie. Unfortunately, if the battlecruiser did need to come to their rescue, the operation would be blown, and with it, the lives of 289 keepers put at terrible risk. If Smythe's priority was to minimize risk to himself, he would have stayed in his bunk that morning.
60 kilometers, he noted.
The buffeting as he fell through increasingly thick air was merely a gentle rocking motion, though there were times when his stomach did flip-flops as his suit made course corrections to maintain position relative to green. None of the commandos nor Adams were likely to suffer from nausea, and he could tell from their medical monitors that none of the five were experiencing anything other than a natural excitement as they dropped from orbit into action. Heart rates, blood oxygen levels, adrenaline levels, all were well within the acceptable range. What the medical monitors could not tell him was how his people were dealing with the novel experience.
Green, status check.
Nominal, the big Marine said tersely. Gunnery Sergeant, while I appreciate your admirable brevity, I was hoping for a bit more detail, How are you feeling?
Feeling, sir?
His voice reflected astonishment that the Star Team leader would ask the question.
Yes, Green. You are parachuting from orbit, dropping in stealth toward an enemy base where we expect to wreak havoc on unsuspecting lizards, and rescue a group of people who have to be kicking themselves for making one of the worst judgment calls in human history. If all goes well, our extraction will be covered by the guns of the most powerful warship in the galaxy.
In that case, sir, Green paused. I feel pretty freaking great about it.
Smythe chuckled.
I feel pretty damned great myself. Savor this moment, Gunnery Sergeant. You will have a story to tell your grandchildren someday.
I would rather savor killing a whole lot of lizards, but I get your point, Colonel.
Smythe checked in with the other four members of his team, assessing their mental states, then contacted Captain Frey.
So far, sir, she said over a yawn. This is kind of dull.
I will endeavor to make it more exciting for you next time, Captain.
No need for that, she laughed. It will get kinetic soon enough.
Sir? What, Frey?
Does it seem weird to you that we don't have some elaborate cover story to blame this on someone else?
It does indeed feel strange, he agreed. I am so accustomed to sneaking around the galaxy, I have to remind myself that isn't necessary.
40 kilometers. Parachute balloons will be deploying soon.
She took the hint to cut the chatter, but could not resist adding,
If this is our last combat drop together, sir, it has been a privilege.
Likewise, Captain.
The parachutes opened in unison, suit computers ensuring all members of both teams remained within their stealth fields. At first, the parachutes were long, thin drogues, serving primarily to slow the descent so the air pressure did not rupture the gossamer-thin material. At 20 kilometers, the stealth field expanded to its maximum diameter, a setting it could only hold for 12 minutes before the components overheated and burned out. That was not a problem, for the power cell wouldn't last much longer than that. Also, if the paratroopers were not on the ground by then, stealth would not be of much use. Once the stealth field was holding stable at full power, the formation spread out with the person carrying the stealth generator in the center. When the paratroops were falling at just under the speed of sound, the chutes flared out and inflated, forming teardrop-shaped balloons. Margaret Adams centered the crosshairs in her visor on the building that was her target. Before her boots touched the flat surface of the roof, the soles inflated and spread out like cushioned snowshoes. The instant the bottom of the clown shoes contacted the roof, a yellow warning flashed in her visor. A faint active sensor pulse sent out by her shoes determined the roof in that area was structurally weak. Yellow, rather than red, indicated she was not in danger of falling through the roof. The danger was from creaking sounds of stress being heard inside the building. Without her needing to do anything, the tether compressed, lifting her less than a meter. She sat down again along one of the I-beams that ran under the roof, the unseen structural member outlined in her synthetic vision. 20%, 30, 60, then the full weight of herself, her suit, and weapons were pressing on the roof. Sensors detected a slight settling, but the I-beam did not sag.
Satisfied she was safe, and knowing the balloon high above her could not remain on station much longer before the breeze tugged it away, she pressed a button, and the tether detached from her backpack.
"Thank you, Skippy," she whispered.
The only reply from the elder AI was a very professional 2 clicks on the transmitter. He knew she was still pissed at him for bailing on the pirates, that she would probably never get over being upset about it. Maybe she could deal with it and move on. If the AI didn't do anything outrageously dishonorable again. At the moment, she had more important things to think about. A glance at the box in the bottom left corner of her visor showed the entire team was down safely, on target, and had not been detected. Captain Frey's team was touching down right then with no indication of trouble. To her left, on the other side of a 3-story building between them, Lamar Green had set down on top of a sturdy warehouse, a structure considered best able to handle the extra weight of the stealth field generator. The stealth field was deactivated, and Green would be securing the valuable device for retrieval later. If that was not possible, it would be instructed to melt down into a puddle of disorganized goo. "Good luck, Lamar," she thought. Taking a tentative step forward along the hidden I-beam, she watched the decibel meter that measured exterior sound levels. There was only a faint creaking sound as she trod along the beam toward the roof hatch. 4 stout beams converged there. It was one of the strongest parts of the roof in an old building that had seen better days. She could see the outlines of seams in the covering that kept rain out of the structure, and everything looked worn and tired, including the hatch she had to go through to get inside. Access to the interior of the dormitory buildings had been a major problem in planning the operation. There were no windows. The original windows were sealed over with tough composite panels, as was the back door. The only way in was the front door, next to the guard station that was constantly occupied by at least 2 soldiers, and the roof hatch. Originally, the interior stairwell went up to the roof, where a hatch set at a 45-degree angle provided access to the roof for maintenance. When the building was converted to a secure facility for holding human slaves, the hatch had been welded shut. Kneeling carefully next to the hatch, she slung her rifle and pulled out the cutting torch. Even if the lock and hinges were not welded solidly, she would have not trusted them to move without making a horrible screeching noise. The cutter had been modified specifically for that job. It made quick work of slicing through all 3 hinges. Holding the hot material in her suit gloves, she placed each severed hinge on the roof, then cut a circle around the lock, using the cutter's magnet to ensure it did not fall to clatter down the stairs. Turning the cutter off and jamming it back in its holster, she took out a can of spray lubricant and liberally coated the edges of both hatch doors before lifting 1 door. It came free silently, and holding her breath, laid it flat on the roof. The other door stuck a bit, and when a swarm of insects flew up, she understood why. Some insects had built a nest under the hatch. That nest was hard like concrete. Feeling around underneath, she crushed the nest with her powered gloves, ignoring the angry insects, and lifted the hatch door away. An icon in her visor told her she was 29 seconds ahead of schedule. "Shit," she whispered.
"Adams," Smythe called. "Trouble?"
"No."
She looked down at the stairs with dismay, knowing she could forget about being ahead of schedule.
"Some asshole crammed the stairs here full of junk. I'll need to move it before I can go inside."
"Same here,"
the voice of Captain Frey announced.
"Old cans of paint, bed frames, and what looks like a stove. Who lugs a stove up the stairs to get rid of it? I'll bet someone was ordered to police the place and did it the laziest way they could."
Adams snorted.
"The lizards must have corporals or specialists in their armies."
Smythe's tone made it clear he was annoyed by the chatter and the situation.
"Can you handle it, Adams?"
"Yes, sir." "We've got it," Frey reported.
"Keep me apprised of your progress," Smythe ordered.
There was a lot of junk crammed into the sealed-off stairway, but taking a moment to assess the problem, Adams decided she only needed to clear the top 3 steps. From the 3rd step, she could get a grip on a beam under the roof and swing herself over the remaining trash. Hauling out old cans, bins overflowing with trash, and some tangled piece of metal she could not guess the function of, she made enough room to climb down, get a firm grip on the beam, and swing herself over the pile of junk.
Wedging her boots against the walls on each side, she did a Spider-Man down to the landing at the bottom. Only 3 seconds behind schedule. Above the door that was welded shut was the lens of a security camera, and pleased with herself, she waggled her fingers at the lens. The lizards weren't watching. Only Skippy was.
Skippy, please show Captain Frey how I got down here. It might help her.
Joe, Skippy shouted excitedly. She waved at me.
I was annoyed at him for distracting me.
Who did what? Margaret. She waved at me, and she called me Skippy.
That's great. Did she ask you to do something?
Yes.
Did you do it?
Oops. Doing it now,